All right, welcome back. We're excited to start the latest class of the Moments That Mattered, great 20th century historical events. And tonight, I am very excited to be able to speak with you about the Kol HaOlam movement in America. Now, someone asked me today a question that I didn't really think about, but the truth is I should have factored in. They said, Rabbi, I assume the entire class is going to be about the BRS Men's Afternoon Kol HaOlam that just started on Thursday. So it happens to be, Baruch Hashem, we have an afternoon kol that meets now three times a week on Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday afternoons for anyone that's interested. But somehow that didn't make it into our discussion this evening. However, what I do want to do is take you on a journey from some of the earliest kolels that we know about in history and really focus on the kol HaOlam movement in America. And obviously a discussion about the Kol HaOlam movement in America is going to be primarily focused around the Lakewood Yeshiva. Rav Aaron Cutler will do a significant amount speaking about him. And I really want to talk about is the impact that the Kol HaOlam movement has had on America over the last 100 years and continuing into the 21st century. So that's our broad agenda tonight, to discuss historically, to discuss the transition to America, and again, for our purposes, really, the great impact that it has had and continues to have on American culture. We start really with the first mention of what I think is a yeshiva or a kolel in the Torah, and that is Yeshiva Shem Ve'Ever. Right? Many of us are familiar that when Rivka has the twins in her stomach and they are fighting, they're jostling a little bit, and so Rivka becomes a little bit concerned, because every time she walks by one place, one of the children starts kicking, and every time she walks by another place, another of the children starts kicking, and so she doesn't know what to do. So says Rashi here, right, what does it mean by Yirotzitzu? As an expression of running. When she passed the entrances of Yeshivat Shem Ve'Ever, Yaakov would run and struggle to come out. And when she would pass the entrance of a house of idolatry, then, of course, Esav would run and try to get out. So we have this concept, and it really is a class in and of itself. I was thinking about it this week. But this concept of Yeshivat Shem Ve'Ever, we see it again at the end of the Akedah. At the beginning of Parshas Vayetze, when Yaakov is running away from Yitzchak after usurping the brothers. Well, he's running away from the episode of Yitzchak and Esav. And he finds himself, right, and we meet him again at Har Moriah with the rocks underneath his head. And Rashi does a very lengthy calculation of where Yaakov spent all of the time in between the end of last week's Parsha and the beginning of Parsha's 8-7. And Rashi tells us, thus you learn that after he received the blessings, he concealed himself in Yeshivat Shem Ve'Ever for 14 years. It's based on the Gemara. But he received no punishment for them on the account of a merit of having studied the Torah in Ever's school during that time. So you have this kind of secretive yeshiva. This yeshivat Shem Ve'Ever, of course, Shem was whose child? Noach's child, right? So apparently Shem and Ever had a yeshiva. And we know that Yaakov was very excited about it. So much so that even in the womb he was drawn to it. And he spends 14 years in Yeshivat Shem Ve'Ever. Parenthetically, Rashi tells us that for those 14 years, what doesn't he do? Sleep. Rashi says he doesn't sleep for 14 years in Yeshivat Shem Ve'Ever. So whatever they were teaching is of a heck of a lot more interesting than what Rabbi Goldberg and I teach here on Shabbos morning. Because we got like 15 minutes with you guys, and I wish you could say you didn't sleep for those 15 minutes. So we have this concept already in the time of the Torah of going into a yeshiva, into an enclave, separating yourself off, right? That's what Yaakov does. The psukim are mysterious about where Yaakov is, possibly on purpose, because that's the point of a yeshiva. It's somewhat of an enclave. It's where you are blocked off from the rest of the world. We have another instance of a yeshiva, and that is last week's Parsha. Pasuk tells us, Ve'es Yehuda shalach lefanav el Yosef, lehoros lefanav goshna ve'yavo arza goshen, that before Yaakov agrees to come down to Mitzrayim, so he sends Yehuda ahead. And many of us might be familiar with Rashi's comment, that why does he send him ahead? to establish himself. Oh, I got this time. Here we go. To establish for him a house of study from which Torah might go forth. Yaakov realizes that if he's going into exile, what's the number one most important thing? Having a yeshiva. Having an anchor of Torah, a place where people can learn, and which is going to guide and anchor the values that you hold near and dear. Why does Yaakov insist Mitzrayim? Because again, exile is a unique place with a unique set of challenges. And Yaakov realizes right off the bat that the first thing you need to set up, and keep this in mind, the first thing you set up when you go into a new place is you need to set up a base medrash. You need to set up a yeshiva. So those are just two examples that we might be familiar with, but I think in many ways, thematically, it sets the background for a lot of what we are going to talk about today. When we talk about Kol Olim, we have to talk about what the purpose of a Kol El is. Now that sounds like a silly question, because many of us are familiar with the word Kol El, right? I just referenced at the beginning. We talk about the BRS afternoon Kol El. But when I talk about the purpose of a Kol El, I'm talking about a purpose of a Kol El in the 19th century. Transport yourself back to the 19th century, and what was the purpose of a Kol El back then? So there really were two distinct purposes of Kol Olim back then. Number one was to incentivize gifted individuals to continue studying Torah. Now you say, right, what kind of rationale is that? My grandchild might be studying Kol El. We know that Kol Els are, thank God, somewhat ubiquitous in American culture. Why do we need to greatly incentivize gifted individuals to continue Torah study? The answer is, because again, you have to transport yourself back to the 19th century. In America, yes. In America, it's very easy after students finish college to say, you know what, I'm going to take a couple years off to learn. Right? I'm going to go to Israel for the year. I might go to YU. I might learn in a yeshiva before going to college. I might not go to college. Right? Nowadays, we have all those options. Back then, it was much more limited. And the reason why it was much more limited is the finances of it. Nowadays, I could afford to, or many can afford, to graduate high school. I can go to a base medrash. I can go to Israel for the year. I can graduate college. And students nowadays, all the time, after college, they go to find themselves. Some go to Guatemala, some go to Honduras, some go to India, and some go to a base medrash. Because nowadays we have the financial flexibility and luxury to be able to do that. Back then it wasn't like that. Back then, from a very early year age, you had to make a choice. And at whatever the age was, 10, 11, and 12, you either stopped schooling altogether, and you had to go into an apprenticeship, basically. You had to go get a job. Or, what did you have to do? Or you went into an elite yeshiva. And you only went into an elite yeshiva if you yourself were elite. Right? The entrance exams to the yeshiva was very different than the entrance exam that I had when I got into yeshiva. Right? When I went into yeshiva, if I could fumble my way through a word of Gemara, they're like, good enough, you're in. Okay? Back then it wasn't like that. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of pages of Talmud memorized completely and analyzed just to be able to get into the yeshiva. So the litmus test to get in was significant. So number one is, you want to incentivize gifted individuals to continue Torah study. Torah study back then was very different than Torah study now. You can be married, have children, be in Kol El, sometimes be supported by parents or grandparents, but live a somewhat decent quality of life. Back then it wasn't like that. Being in yeshiva meant going to a completely foreign town. You were completely dependent on the locals for hospitality, for financial support, for food, right? You didn't eat in a yeshiva dormitory. You oftentimes ate at the local resident's home. So being a yeshiva bachur back then, if you think it was unexciting now, it was much less exciting back then. It was filled with tremendous difficulty and self-sacrifice. And so if you wanted people to stay on in learning, those who were most gifted, you had to give them incentive. And that's what a Kol El did. A Kol El gave you financial incentive, although paltry financial incentive, but it gave you financial incentive to continue. The second thing is you had to create a breeding ground for rabbinic leaders, right? You need a single-A baseball team to be able to be a feeder into the major league. Okay, that's essentially what a Kol El was. A Kol El was a professional school. Okay, guys came there to learn. They didn't learn as long as they did now, right? By the age of 18, 19, 20, many of them had rabbinic positions already because you had to. The financial situation couldn't sustain it. And so again, you needed a yeshiva to be able to create that breeding ground for the next, you know, next generation of rabbinic leaders. When we talk about kolim, I want to define two terms. And that is the difference between a kolel and a yeshiva. And they're two very different terms, and we're going to come back to this over and over again, because it's this tension that's playing out in 1879 with the earliest kolels as we know it forming. Okay, it's going to play out, we'll see, to this very day. And that is as follows. A yeshiva is a place where someone goes to learn. And when I mean when someone goes to learn, it means you go to learn all theoretical aspects of the Gemara. Right? I don't know if those are learning Daf Yomi. So those who are learning Daf Yomi know we're learning Masechta Shavuos. Shavuos isn't exactly the most practical of Masechtas. Right? We have tractates that are much more practical. You can learn Chulin. You can learn Brachos. You can learn Psachim. Right? There are certain tractates that are much more practical. Shavuos is not one of them. Okay? Sanhedrin, Baba Kama, Baba Basar. These aren't necessarily known for their practicality. Okay? In a yeshiva, you learn those. And you learn those because of the way it trains the mind, because of the insight it gives you into how the Torah thinks. There are many reasons to learn those masechtas. Okay, that's in the yeshiva. The kolo was very different. The kolo was an opportunity for professional development. And because it was an opportunity for professional development, there was a tremendous focus on practical code of law. In other words, you were studying things that were going to actually be put into practice, like shechita. Don't forget, back then, they actually shechted animals, and you needed to know, right? They came to the rabbi to ask about that, okay? You needed to know the laws of kashrus. You needed to know, right, the laws of Shabbos. So you studied those practical areas. Number two is there were rabbinic apprenticeships. And those, you didn't just join the kolel and sit and learn all day. You had to have an apprenticeship. Same way if you wanted to be a blacksmith or a printer, you needed an apprenticeship. So too, if you wanted to be a rabbi, you had an apprenticeship. And number three is, there was a term limit. Now, why was there a term limit if you were in yeshiva, if you were in kolel, excuse me? The answer is because, again, the system couldn't support you financially longer than that. This was a breeding ground. It was a breeding ground for the next generation of rabbinic leaders, which meant if you had been in kolel for a number of years, you know what they did? They kicked you out. They said, it's time to go and practice in the real world. So when we talk about this word, the kolel movement, what's interesting and important to note is early kolelim were practical kolelim. Okay, they were meant as almost, I would say, as a professional development schools. And the development being developing the next generation of rabbis. Now we'll see in America, the word kolel takes on an entirely new definition. But that's what I'm setting us up for here. So when we come to the end of the 19th century, kolel is a practical experience. You go to kolel for one reason and one reason only. And that is because you want to be a practicing rabbi. And in order to become a practical rabbi, you had to learn practical things. You had to do an apprenticeship. And eventually they kicked you out because they couldn't afford to have you here. And you needed to earn money in order to sustain your family.
So your definition
is for Europe? The kolel in Europe was that this? Europe. I'm in Europe now. Okay? Now why the practical focus? So again, we discussed a little bit of this. But I'll just draw your attention to one other consideration. Oops. One is the financial consideration that I referenced. The other was a gift from the Russian government. And that is that the Russians insisted that rabbis received professional training in government-sponsored professional schools. Now, those obviously weren't the types of schools that most budding Torah scholars wanted to participate in. And so the only way to counteract that was to create your own professional schools for the rabbis. And again, that is also kind of what the kolel, the form that the kolel turned on. Again, fundraising considerations. When I talk about fundraising considerations, about why you set up a kolel this way, let me ask you a question. What are you more likely to support? A guy comes to your door and says, I want you to support my yeshiva, where guys sit and learn, and nothing practical or productive comes out of it. Okay, that's number one. Pitch number two. I want you to support my kolel, where I am developing the next generation of rabbinic leaders who are going to service your communities and be a source of nachas to Klal Yisrael for many years to come. Right? So the answer is it's much easier to fundraise in the latter than in the former. So it was much easier to fundraise for kolels if there was a practical side to the kolels. It was easier to get people to buy in, to get philanthropists to buy in to the notion of supporting these Torah scholars if the philanthropists felt that there was going to be a return on their investment. If they felt that ultimately these Torah scholars were going to be giving back to society. Okay. Let's come to the personality that we're going to spend the most amount of time talking about tonight. And that is Rav Aaron Cutler. Okay? Rav Aaron Cutler is born in 1891. At the age of 14 years old, he begins learning in the famous Slabodka Yeshiva. When he hits 14 years old, this is the heyday of the famous Slabodka Yeshiva. 1914, he marries the daughter of Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. Now, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer is an interesting personality in and of himself. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer studies in the Volozhin Yeshiva. He was chosen by the altar of Slabodka to be the Rosh Yeshiva of Slabodka. Before that, in Volozhin, he becomes part of a Zionist group called Neis Tziona, which is important because Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer is going to make Aliyah in the middle of our story. And in 1897, he is chosen to lead a yeshiva in Slutsk. Now, we'll get there in a second about Slutsk and Kletsk. That's not a tongue twister for us tonight. I don't know what is. Okay? Rav Aaron Cutler moves In 1897, the rabbi of the town in Slutsk wants to improve the religious makeup of his community. And so he goes to the altar of Slabodka and he asks for assistance in setting up a yeshiva. And the altar of Slabodka sends a group of boys to start a yeshiva in Slutsk. And to lead the yeshiva, he asks Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer to lead the yeshiva. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer takes his son-in-law along with him. And so Rav Aaron Cutler moves to Slutsk with Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. And in 1917, as part of the Russian Revolution, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer is put into jail. And while he is in jail, Rav Aaron Cutler takes over the yeshiva. Okay? In 1921, so the persecution from the Russians becomes so severe. Now, I'll share with you why all this is important, why I'm sharing this with you about a discussion about kolels in America. Okay, in 1921, the persecution in Russia becomes so severe that the yeshiva splits into two. Half of the yeshiva stays in Slutsk and half of them goes to Kletsk. Now, you're wondering, why are half going to Kletsk and why are half staying in Slutsk? The answer is this slide right here. Okay? You have here Volozhin, just to give you a little bit of a geographical anchor, so to speak. Here's Slutsk, and here's Kletsk. So here's the original yeshiva. This part of the yeshiva finds its way onto the Russian side. There's a border that emerges right in between these two, which even though they look so close in proximity, Slutsk ends up under Russian control, and Kletsk ends up under Polish control. And so half of the yeshiva goes to Poland, which is safe, and half of the yeshiva stays back in Slutsk. So let's go to this slide back, okay? So again, half of it goes to, stays in Slutsk, and the other half goes to Kletsk, which again is a safer area, okay? In 1923, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer and the entire yeshiva is forced to move from Slutsk to Kletsk. And in 1924, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer moves to Israel, paving the way for his son, Rav Aaron Cutler, to become the Rosh Yeshiva in Kletsk. Now, this is important because Rav Aaron Cutler, when he becomes the Rosh Yeshiva, his population, his reputation continues to grow, and he becomes one of the most prominent rabbis throughout all of Lithuania. So much so that he becomes the head of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, the what we'll call like the overarching body of rabbinic scholars. And in 1929, the Beis Medrash becomes so popular in Kletsk that it actually has to move into a new building. So Rav Aaron Cutler, over a decade basically, from 1921 when they moved to Kletsk to 1929, his population, his notoriety explodes. He becomes a Rosh Yeshiva, and more importantly, the yeshiva is bursting at the seams. Okay? By the end of the 1939, so the yeshiva is forced to close. Why is the yeshiva forced to close? Because in 1939, when the Nazis invade Poland, Lithuania is still independent. And so many of the yeshivas leave Lithuania and leave Poland and come to Lithuania and set up shop in Vilna, which is where Kletsk was. Quickly, the Soviets move in, split the yeshiva up into three, and the yeshiva by the end of 1939 closes. Most of the boys in the yeshiva will end up dying. 1939 is an important date because in 1939, Rav Aaron Cutler goes on a fundraising trip to the United States of America. And it's there in America, 1939, that he meets a man, maybe familiar to many of you the name, a man by the name of Irving Bunim. Irving Bunim is a significant American philanthropist. He had early involvement in Yeshiva University. 1940, with the war in full swing, so there's an attempt by Americans, by the Vahd Hatzala, to get certain VIPs out of Europe and to save certain VIPs. And they give a visa, they extend a visa to Rav Aaron Cutler. There's only one problem with Rav Aaron Cutler's visa, and that is he can't pay for the visa. And they need to raise money to in order to get Rav Aaron Cutler out of Europe and to bring him to the United States. What I want to share with you is an interview with Irving Bunim. Is it with Irving Bunim? Hold on, I'll tell you, sorry. It's an interview with, Irving Bunim, about how he was able to successfully raise the money to bring Rav Aaron Cutler. And I share this with you, both because I think it's historically interesting, and to show you, right, the desperation that there was to get people to America. So Irving Bunim says the following. During the war, Rabbi Cutler was stuck in Russia. I knew about him, so I helped get him out. One Shabbos afternoon, I was sitting and having lunch when Rabbi Baruch Kaplan, a founder of the Orthodox Beth Jacob Schools, and Rabbi Sender Lynchner, a son-in-law of Rabbi Mendelowitz, came over in a cab. Right? Now, notice what I said. One Shabbos noon, they come over in a cab. Rabbi Feinstein, Rabbi Hyman, and Rabbi Mendelowitz sent them to me in a cab on Shabbos to go and raise money for that purpose. In other words, the purpose of bringing Rav Aaron Cutler to the United States. I think it was 1940. He was right. So we went to Flatbush in a cab. They wanted to lynch me there in Flatbush for violating Shabbos by traveling in an automobile. But the rabbis there, we convinced them. This is how we raised the money. Then we took it to the Joint Distribution Committee and they made the arrangements. Asked the interviewer, we'll get to these interviews, William Heimreich, right? Why did you feel it was necessary to go on Shabbos? For two reasons. First, we needed the money immediately. And second, the idea was to create a commotion so that they shouldn't sleep on it, right? Could you imagine Rav Asher Weiss, Rav David Cohn, and Rav Schechter showing up at BRS on Shabbos morning because they needed a check from Rabbi Goldberg's discretionary fund. Okay? Would that cause a stir in Shul? You bet ya. And that's exactly what happens. This gives you a little bit of an insight into the drama that existed back then. And this was real pikuach nefesh. Right? As we know, tragically. If people were able to leave Europe, they survived. If they didn't leave Europe, they did not. They were able to raise the money, of course. And they were able to bring Rav Aaron Cutler over to the United States. He takes a boat over to San Francisco, and then he takes a cross-country train to New York City, and he arrives in New York City on April 23, 1941. Now, Rav Aaron Cutler says that he had two stated goals for what his purpose in America are. Number one, and most importantly, is to save European Jewry. Rav Cutler felt that his number one priority coming to America was to work tirelessly to raise the funds in order to save as many Jewish souls as possible. In my next slide, I'll share with you a crazy story about that notion. Number two is obviously he wants to reestablish Torah in America. Right? Think about what we learned at the beginning of this class. When Yaakov is about to go to Mitzrayim, what's the first thing that he does? He sends Yehuda ahead. Because he says, if I'm going to go into exile, I need a base medrash with me. So Rav Aaron Cutler says, if I'm going to be in America, I'm going to reestablish Torah. Those are his two significant goals. I think if you asked him, what would his primary goal be? His primary goal would have been to save European Jewry. Right? That's where he spent most of his time. In fact, even once he opens the Lakewood Yeshiva, throughout the duration of his tenure as Rosh Yeshiva, he did not live in Lakewood. He continues to live in New York and to travel. He lives in Borough Park. And the reason why he lives in Borough Park, even though the yeshiva is in Lakewood, is because he needs to raise money. And there was a lot more money in Borough Park than there was at Lakewood at the time. And that was his primary concern. His primary concern was to be able to raise the money to save as many people as possible. You can't read this as well as I can. And I put it here for two reasons. A, I'm going to read it for you. And B, you'll have it in the packet also. You can read it later. But this is an interview with Amos Bunim, which is Irving Bunim's son. And he was asked the following question. Can you give us an example of a Hatzalah incident involving your father and Rav Aaron? I don't know who the Rav Aaron there he's talking about there. He answers as follows. Yes. Toward the end of the war, you know what, instead of me reading backwards, he says the following, and you can try to read it on the screen. He says, towards the end of the war, they received a cable from Hatzalah heroes, Rav Yitzchak and Mrs. Recha Sternbach from Switzerland. A ransom deal had been negotiated with Himmler, the head of the SS, whereby it would be possible to ransom Jews. The deal was that every month for 20 months they would pay $250,000 and the Nazis would release 15,000 Jews. It came roughly to $17 a person. Even those numbers are just haunting, to put numbers on people that way. Just struck me as, I mean, the whole thing is horrific, but for some reason those numbers struck me a considerable amount. They immediately needed a down payment of $1.2 million. The Varatzala raised $230,000, but they were still short $970,000. Rav Aaron decided to seek assistance from the Joint Distribution Committee and approached Mr. Mo Levitt, the head of the joint, to ask for the loan. Levitt absolutely refused to transfer funds to the enemy and pay ransom. He said, "You came to the wrong person. We are against bribes." My father became furious and told Levitt, right, this is Rivaro now, "If you don't lend us the money that will save Jews from death, I will send a letter to every single member of the joint telling them exactly what you have done." Deal or no deal? Levitt got scared and reluctantly agreed to the loan. The sole condition was that the United States government grant the Vad Hatzalah a license to transfer the funds overseas to Switzerland and then through their agents to Himmler. It was a condition which Levitt felt the Vad could never meet. In other words, Levitt's smart. He says, I'll give you the money, but on one condition, right? Jump up and down on your head 15 times. And he obviously thinks the condition isn't going to be met, and therefore he doesn't have to worry. Rav Aaron and my father went to Washington. I'm over here for those who are trying to follow along. Rav Aaron and my father went to Washington to petition President Roosevelt, who directed them to the only Jew in his cabinet, Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau. When the proposal was first made, Morgenthau balked, saying that the United States cannot authorize the transfer of funds to the enemy. Upon hearing Morgenthau's answer, Rav Aaron began to shake, and with his eyes flashing, he told my father, who served as a translator, "Tell him that if he cannot help to rescue his fellow Jews at this time, then he is worth nothing, and his position is worth nothing, because one Jewish life is worth more than all the positions in Washington. Right? Very similar to the story of Esther. My father understood that diplomacy dictated that he cannot repeat verbatim what Rav Aaron had said. And he took the edge off of Aaron's words, saying, "There comes a time in history when you have to help your brothers." Rav Aaron immediately understood that my father had not properly conveyed what he said, and he turned to my father and commanded him to tell Morgenthau exactly what he had said. Fearing the worst, my father conveyed Rav Aaron's exact words, but instead of becoming angry, Morgenthau put his head down on his desk for a few minutes. Finally, he picked up his head, and with great emotion, he authorized the transfer. Crazy story. I share it with you because I think it showcases the passion that Rav Aaron has for the Vadat Tzala, the importance that he plays in saving Jewish lives. I think it also gives you a great insight into his, what I'm going to call Akshanus. Akshanus means his stubbornness, not a bad stubbornness, but a healthy stubbornness, an uncompromising stubbornness about the values that you hold near and dear. And if you think this is going to save Jewish lives, you will stop at nothing to get it done. And that is a trait that we are going to see manifest itself as we talk more about the Lakewood Yeshiva. First yeshiva in 1942 is opened in White Plains, New York. Now, the geography of this is going to be important. Because if you look on a map, White Plains is here, right? You have New York City here. Here you have, what's that? What's the road that goes?
Westchester County.
Westchester County. What's that? The Major Deacon, is that what it is? 87, Henry Unson. I've been out of New York for a while. Thank God, I don't remember. Thruway, that's it. Thank you. The Thruway. Hey, it's a good thing, by the way, that I don't remember these things. Right? PTSD. PTSD. Okay? I know how to get from my house to Shul. That's about it right now. Okay, so you have White Plains to New York. Anyone want to guess about how far of a drive that is? A little less than an hour, probably 45, 50 minutes. Okay, it's pretty close. Right, there's a train that goes from one to the other. And in between here are, you have some significant places. Don't forget, at the time, Yonkers wasn't the Yonkers of today. The Bronx was the Bronx, right? That was the heyday. Okay, so there were significant Jewish populations linking the big lights of the city with White Plains. Rav Aaron says, if I'm going to become the Rosh Yeshiva, it can't be in White Plains, New York. And so he and Irving Bunim seek out a new location for the yeshiva, and Rav Aaron Cutler suggests a place in New Jersey named Lakewood. Now Lakewood here, here's Lakewood, here's New York. How far of a drive is it from Lakewood to New York? With no traffic, it's an hour and a half. There's always traffic, right? Don't do it on a Friday, okay? Now, why does Rav Aaron choose Lakewood? So he chooses Lakewood for two reasons. Okay, number one, and this is what we're going to talk about a lot, is it's in the middle of nowhere, okay? If you want a yeshiva, and this is, again, going to be the big theme that we're going to talk about. Rav Aaron Cutler's involvement in Lakewood is premised on the following important notion, and that is a mistrust of American culture. Okay? Rav Aaron distrusted American culture and felt that the only way for Torah to survive is if you block it off from the surrounding culture, and if you block off the boys from the surrounding culture. Put a yeshiva in White Plains, closer proximity to other Jewish communities, in the big lights of New York City, guys are going to be drawn into temptation. Put them in Lakewood, New Jersey, literally in the middle of nowhere, it's much easier to block the guys off and to prevent them from distraction. Okay, this was a consideration, honestly, when I chose my yeshiva in Israel. Right? There were yeshivas in the old city, and there were yeshivas that were far away. I chose a yeshiva far away because I knew myself, and I knew that if I was in the old city, so every other day, there would be a relative coming in, a friend coming in, right? So many distractions. So instead, you go out in the middle of nowhere. There's something nice about that. So Rav Aaron decides that they're going to put the yeshiva in Lakewood. The other reason why they decide to put the yeshiva in Lakewood is, some of you might have this experience, anyone ever vacation Long Branch, Asbury Park, right? You go to the Jersey coast, Jersey Shore in the summer, right? Try making this drive on a summer Friday, okay? Not a lot of fun. That I can tell you from experience, okay? The Jews over here know about Lakewood because they summer vacation there. And so if I were to say Lakewood to you, even though there wasn't a Jewish community there, you would immediately know the place. You would know that it's a beautiful place on the Jersey Shore. And so when I'm going to someone to fundraise, I can't just say I'm going to Wichita, because you're not going to know where Wichita is. You're not going to be excited about that. But if I tell you I'm sending a kollel, I'm building a yeshiva in Lakewood, you're going to say, oh, I know Lakewood. I passed that exit on the Garden City Parkway. So it's familiar to people, right? That's what it's called, right? Garden State Parkway. Whatever. Okay, I've been out of New York for 8 years. Okay, relax. Okay? Garden State Park. Okay? So, right? So it's familiar to people. It has name recognition. And that's critically important when you're trying to fundraise. They're able to raise $15,000, which at that point was a big time, big amount. And in 1943, the Beis Medrash Gavoa, the Lakewood Yeshiva, opens up its doors to 14 students. First few years, it goes from 14 students to around 40 students. By the time Rav Aaron Cutler dies in December 1962, it has 220 students. And nowadays, it's outstanding. Over 6,500 married and undergraduate students learning in the Lakewood Yeshiva. Now, we call it the Lakewood Yeshiva. It's a enterprise, right? It's not just one building. It's a whole operation there, but that's for another time. Okay, so Rav Aaron Cutler comes to America and builds the Lakewood Yeshiva. What is unique about the Lakewood Yeshiva? Okay, why am I spending so much time on Lakewood in particular? If you recall when I was describing the Kollel of 1879, I described how the purpose of the Kollel was professional. It was with a goal in mind. It was a means to an end. And the end was to produce rabbis. Lakewood was a little bit different. I have here an excerpt from the book called The Legacy of Maharam Rav Aaron Cutler, where he talks about the goal of Lakewood. And I want to spend a few minutes reading. And a lot of what we're going to do now is reading, because I want to develop for you a philosophy of what Rav Aaron Cutler was trying to do. He writes here, there was a major difference between the situation in Europe and the situation the Rosh Yeshiva, named Rav Aaron Cutler, found in America. In Europe, the groundwork for Harbatas HaTorah, the Torah dissemination, was there. The concept of ideal studying Torah Lishma, Torah Hashem for its own sake, because of its inherent value as the word of Hashem, was ingrained in European B'nai Yeshiva from the time of Rechaim Volozhin, the Vilna Gaon, and before. In other words, in Europe, they understood the notion of learning for the sake of learning. Not so in America, however. The concept, and all the more so the practical possibility of devoting many years in yeshiva and in kollel to total absorption in Torah Lishma, just didn't exist. If one did study Torah longer than the norm in yeshivos, it was in preparation for a career in Rabbanus or Chinuch, right? It was a means to an end. What Rav Aaron brought about was a spiritual revolution, both in the America yeshiva itself, as well in the minds of American philanthropists, to whom the entire idea of authentic yeshivas on American soil was a novel idea of studying Torah Lishma after marriage was outlandish. Right? The notion of taking a boy, 19, 20, 25 years old, and saying, I'm going to ask you for money to support him learning in yeshiva for no reason other than the fact that he's learning the Torah of Hashem was foreign to American soil. It did not exist in America. And Rav Aaron Cutler felt strongly that Torah in America should be learned for one purpose and one purpose only. And that is what he calls Lishma, which means for the right reason. Not because I'm entering into the rabbinate, not because it's going to earn me money, not because it even might help you in the long run, but because you want Torah learned. And that was the novelty of the Lakewood Yeshiva. Here's a different formulation of it from an article by Adam Furziger. He writes, in Rav Aaron Cutler's estimation, what was needed most in post-World War II Jewish America was a group of Jews that repudiated the idealized vision of integration of Judaism in American culture. Authentic Judaism could develop in America only if a core population isolated itself. This is, notice the use of words. Isolated itself physically and concentrated exclusively on enriching its own Jewish knowledge and commitment. The key to achieving this goal, in his opinion, was to establish a structure on American soil that would enable young men to dedicate themselves to Torah studies for a considerable number of years after they married and begun a family. In other words, in America, where they wanted to integrate, think about the people that came over to America. Okay? Think about the values that they had. So number one is you wanted to integrate into American culture, right? I don't want to use the word assimilate because that has a very negative connotation, but you definitely wanted to integrate yourself. And number two, what was the American ideal at the time? The American ideal was to roll up your sleeves and to put in a hard day's work. You had to work hard. And the notion in 1943, of sitting and doing nothing other than learning Torah and getting paid for that was completely foreign to the American ideals. Right? That was a negative, that was completely foreign to people. Now, why did Rav Aaron Cutler feel that this was so important? His entire philosophy builds itself off of a negative evaluation of American society. Right? He viewed American culture as inherently negative. And therefore, the only way to protect yourself from it is to separate yourself from it. And that's exactly what he does. The uniqueness of Lakewood. And again, think about what we discussed at the beginning of this class when I introduced you to the Kolim of the late 19th century. The uniqueness of Lakewood is there's no time limit placed on studying there. Right? They don't kick you out after a certain time. Stay there for as long as you want. Number two, students were specifically not to involve themselves with the local community. It was the exact opposite paradigm of what existed in Europe in the 19th century, where there was a rabbinic apprenticeship, where there was involvement of the students with the local community. They were eating meals with them. They were in the local base medrash. Here it was a totally different paradigm. You were supposed to distance yourself as opposed to involve yourself. And lastly, there was nothing professional about this. This was solely about learning Torah Lishma. This was not a preparation for a role in the rabbinate. It was not about a preparation for a role in education. It was simply because we believe the Torah of Hashem needs to be learned. That was the stated unique goals of the Lakewood Yeshiva. In an interview with William Helmreich, who wrote a book about yeshivas in America, so he interviews Rav Schneer Cutler. Rav Schneer Cutler is Rav Aaron Cutler's son, who takes over as Rosh Yeshiva after. And in the interview, he's asked, Rav Schneer Cutler is asked about the obstacles to the success of the yeshiva. So first he says the obstacle is that Rav Aaron Cutler's head was scattered. He wasn't fully invested in the yeshiva. Why? Because what else was he involved in? Vada Atzala, right? There was an article on the front page of the Wall Street Journal today about Under Armour. Right, Under Armour is like Nike and Adidas. It's a sports. What? Sports apparel. Thank you. That was the word I was looking for. Right, sports apparel. So the CEO, apparently their stock has tanked. It's gone down like 49%, even though the market's up significantly. And the investors are getting frustrated. Why? Because the CEO has opened up a whole slew of side businesses. And the whole article in the Wall Street Journal today was about whether those side businesses was taking his focus away from Under Armour. That's exactly what Rav Schneer Cutler says was one of the impediments to success of Lakewood, one of the obstacles. Rav Aaron Cutler's focus was scattered. That on the one hand, there was Lakewood, but as I said, more importantly was a focus on the Vada Atzala. And then he says the following. The second obstacle was that my father felt that there should be Torah Lishma, and that all practical benefits would come from it anyways. Right, again, Torah Lishma. And anything that, whether people joined the rabbinate, didn't, it was all secondary. Most important thing was that people were learning. He felt that Torah Lishma raised tremendously the general level of the Jewish community. The problem was that this was, again, the spirit of the country. Again, picture yourself in 1943 telling, right, during the war, that no, we're not going to work. We're not going to help the war effort. We're going to sit in a little enclave in Lakewood and learn, and we want you to support us. How's that going to play out? The people asked, what is the tachlis of studying Torah? What can be gained from it? Again, think about the kolim at the end of the 19th century. There was a practical output from these kolim, and that's what made them easily sellable. Here, people are wondering, what do I get from having, you know, Yankli Shmuluitz learning in Lakewood? What do I gain from that? This was the attitude. It was hard to explain that sometimes the most lasting things seem to come out from things which seem to have no purpose. Right, which is an interesting line, right? Lasting things seem to come out of things which seem to have no purpose. Okay? Put differently, this is a great quote from Mrs. Sarah Cutler Schwartzman, of Aaron's daughter, where again she says in an interview, woe is the success of Lakewood. She says the success of Lakewood was Rav Aaron did not hide behind what the yeshiva was actually about. Right? He was authentic. He didn't try to pretend like they were trying to accommodate American culture. He was forthright with what the goals of the yeshiva were and what they weren't. So she says the following. Father often used to challenge Balabatim on what, in other words, to raise money. On one such occasion, at an emergency fundraising meeting, he put it in approximately these words. I don't want you to misunderstand me. I don't want to mislead you. There is a need for Rosh Yeshivas in this country and elsewhere, and Lakewood will produce them. There is a need for effective teachers of the right kind of rabbis, and Lakewood will produce these too. There is a need for Balabatim, Talmidei Chachamim, and Lakewood will send them forth. However, the raison d'etre of Lakewood is Limud Torah Lishma, to learn Torah for its own sake. It is with this understanding and for this purpose that I'm asking for your support. Right? Rav Aaron Cutler was unapologetic to his philosophy and to his approach. He was not trying to pretend that it was one thing when in fact it was another. And she goes on to say that she thinks that is ultimately what attributes the success of the Lakewood Yeshiva, was that everyone knew what it was. He created this new movement where learning Torah was valuable as a value in and of itself, and not so much because it led to anything. It simply was the primacy of Torah for Torah's own sake. And again, the reason why I set you up at the beginning of the class with a discussion of Kolim in the end of the 19th century is because I want you to appreciate just how unique of a model that was. That people should come to America and that they should do nothing more than sit and learn for the sake of sitting and learning. I'll share with you one last quote, which I also found interesting. This again with Rav Schneer Cutler, where he says, and again this is a little bit of shtuch to me, but that's okay, right? He says, the modern rabbis in the Orthodox community, they fit right in. They spoke English, dressed in the right clothes. So where did it get them? Many of the congregants left the religion. There is no solution to compromise. If you want to succeed, you cannot compromise or give in. You have to be strong. Okay? That is Rav Schneer Cutler saying, what is the reason for Lakewood success? You cannot compromise on your values. Again, this is all built upon a general negative evaluation of American culture. Why does Rav Aaron Cutler put Lakewood in Lakewood? Why does he think White Plains isn't going to be far enough? Why does he believe he doesn't want his students to have any involvement in the general community, whether it's secular studies, Zionism, whether it's involved? Because you're learning Torah for Torah's sake. And if you're willing to not compromise on that value, that is ultimately what's going to make it successful. Now, I'm going to be a little bit rough on some other yeshivas for a second, but that's not my intention. Okay? I went to YU. I'm YU through and through. I want to make that clear. But I'm showing you the next two slides because I want to show you language, how language matters. What is the language of the last few slides? Learning Torah for Torah's sake. Not for professional purposes whatsoever. Right? We will, right? Remember what said, what did Rav Aaron Cutler said? We will supply the yeshivas and the Talmidei Chachamim, but that's not our goal. Our sole goal is, we want you to learn Torah. Contrast that, I came across this, and I just think, again, I'm beating up on my yeshiva for a second, but that's not my goal. My goal is simply to show you how unique the Lakewood model was. This is from the YU's website, from Reitz, that's Israel Yitzchak Elkanan Theological Seminary, which is YU. Ooh, the whole bottom got cut off. That's not fun. Okay, it says the following. I'll read you this part. Kolo programs serve scholars of exceptional promise who wish to devote all their academic energies to the areas of Talmud and Halacha. Each program, this is the key line, each program is designed for students with distinct career goals, whether in Jewish education, the rabbinate, Jewish scholarship, or other pursuits both in and out of Avodas HaKodesh. Right? Again, I just think the language there is important. Again, not I love YU, but I want to contrast it with the language that we saw in the comments of Rav Schneer Cutler, of Aaron Cutler, of Aaron Cutler's daughter, where this was not the goal. Right? The distinct career goal. It wasn't designed for a goal, a career in education, the rabbinate, or Jewish scholarship. What was it designed for? It was designed to learn. It was designed to remind Americans about the primacy of Torah learning. I'll just point out this interesting. There was a whole dispute in YU recently, a few years ago, where a student wrote an article in The Commentator, which is the YU newspaper, encouraging the yeshiva to shift from learning impractical masechtas to learning practical tractates. And he makes a whole argument, and I'm not going to read it, you can read it on your own, but he makes a whole argument for why it would be better if the yeshiva learned practical masechtas, right? And some of the Rosh Yeshivas responded in saying, why should the whole goal of learning be practical? Isn't there a value in learning Torah for Torah's sake? So that tension that we experienced earlier between the yeshiva and the kolel, between learning for learning's sake and learning practically, happens to this very day, okay? Learning Torah lishma, what we'll call lishma, versus learning it because you want a career in the rabbinate or in education. Okay, and again, you can read that on your own. It's interesting. Up until now, we've discussed the Kolo movement in very narrow terms, which is I've spent a lot of time talking about Lakewood, arguably really the first significant Beis Medrash Kolel in America, okay? 6,500 students to this day. At some point, the yeshiva was able to transform itself from being an enclave to being a beacon of light to communities around the country. What I called from survival, right? Because at the beginning, you're just trying to survive in America and you're trying to create your anchor, to expansion. And I want to share with you a quote from Rav Yaakov Shulman, who is the director of Lakewood Community Kolel Program, where he says, the Kolel is viewed as a resettlement program of a slice of the yeshiva ideals and mentality in another community. And so Lakewood, and there, Lakewood starts building satellite yeshivas. I don't want to call them kolels, really. They're satellite yeshivas in communities across North America, whether it's Toronto, whether it's Chicago, whether it's Los Angeles, right? These kolels are sprouting up, and slowly but surely they are changing the communities, right? Again, I think the language is important here, right? It's a resettlement program, right? We're simply taking the yeshiva, which has now been fortified, in the right, the boys that have been fortified in the yeshiva, and we're resettling it in a community. And notice he doesn't say that we are adjusting ourselves to the community, that we are integrating ourselves in the community. What is it? It's a slice of the yeshiva ideals and the mentality in another community. They're simply taking the yeshiva in plopping it down in another community. What is the community kolo? So I thought was the best articulation. It's a quote from Rav Moshe Sternbach. Rav Moshe Sternbach, of course, great posek in Eretz Yisrael, South Africa, where he writes the following. And this was a lecture about community kolo. He says, in most community kololim, the members of the kolo actively participate in the educational needs of the community. This is done in off hours by donating time for classes for adult education. The effect this has on the community is immeasurable. However, more effective in the indirect ripple effect which the kolim have had on the community. The young men who study in the kolim become models for the rest of the community for what Torah culture is all about. The presence of the idealism of young men who give up money and prestige for the pursuit of Jewish knowledge is the most powerful statement of what Jewish values are. In the face of such models, people are forced to re-examine their own scale of values in a Jewish light. At least, they are compelled to find some time during the day when they can devote themselves to Torah wisdom. And once these people begin studying Torah, they themselves become more and more committed to Jewish practices. Right? Slowly but surely, Lakewood decides that they are going to take the model of what works so well in Lakewood, of Torah as a value, and they bring it to communities across North America. Again, I just find the quote so beautiful, right? That it's going to make an impact, the presence of the idealism of young group of men, right? That they're going to reevaluate, right? When you see these boys studying Torah, you're going to reevaluate and reexamine your own fidelity to Torah. You're going to make time for studying Torah. Slowly but surely, it starts transforming communities across North America, right? I know, for example, in Boston, there's a very significant kollel in Boston, right? One which I was involved with, certainly throughout my youth, but even when I went to yeshiva and when I went to get back, I appreciated it even more so because it was a place where you could go at all hours of the day and have a place to learn. That makes an indelible impact on any community you're going to find yourself. Okay? Around 1987, other segments start catching on. And they say, let's not just take this model of what we're going to call Lakewood Kollel, where you take 8 to 10 guys, you plop them down in a community, they learn most of the time, and here and there on off hours, they devote themselves to other forms of learning. But an individual from Ner Yisrael, who we are familiar with, rabbi now, his name is Rabbi Ilan Feldman, whose father, of course, was a rabbi in Atlanta. So he has a crazy idea. He says, why don't we form a kollel in Atlanta, only instead of making it the classic model of a kollel, let's unabashedly make it a outreach kollel. Right? And again, this is a quote that's pulled from the original brochure of the Atlanta Scholars Kollel, which is what they called it, where the quote said, that's okay, we love that song, right? Whether you're Reform, conservative, orthodox, unaffiliated, or somewhere in between, the Atlanta Scholars Kollel is your most vibrant source for Jewish learning in Atlanta, right? This is your first, 1987, is your first outreach kollel, where the defined goal of the kollel isn't just to come to a community and learn and have people watch you, but you are going to do outreach. You are going to go out and find people, notice the language, Reform, conservative, unaffiliated. We are your destination for learning. Now again, a lot of this is so ubiquitous for us nowadays that we're like, of course that happened. 1987, that was a unique idea. 1993, Cleveland, Mr. Stark decides that what's worked so well for what we'll call the Haredi community, the Lakewood community, why shouldn't we recreate that for the religious Zionist community? And so they open in Cleveland a Cleveland Torah Mitzion Kollel based out of the Fuchs Mizrahi school, where they bring people. It's started in a partnership with Shivat Har Etzion Gush, where Gush is going to send students over, English-speaking students. They're going to learn in the Fuchs Mizrahi school. And I think it's interesting also, the language that's used from their brochure. The focus of the kollel's work lies more in the Zionist area than in the religious one. The outreach in which the kollel engages is mostly toward Torat Eretz Yisrael, teaching about the uniqueness of the land and the special mitzvah of living in it. Right? This kolel is about learning, of course. It's about outreach, but its primary focus is to bring the Torat Eretz Yisrael. It's to bring that religious Zionist fervor and zeal to communities across North America. And lastly, of course, because we're talking about the Kol movement, I have to mention it. 1996, the most important Kol of all starts, and that is the Boca Raton Synagogue community, bringing down individuals like Rabbi Ben Sugarman, Rabbi Josh Fass, Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, right, Rabbi Moshe Shaket, all these people who came and have populated so many of our institutions, came down through the Boca Raton Synagogue community kolel. So what we did tonight is I tried to take you on a journey through kolelim over the last 120 years. Really, well, first I started, of course, in the time of Tanakh, but really since the end of the 19th century, when kolels were a professional entity, and you went there because you wanted to study to become a professional rabbi or a professional educator, all of a sudden we become introduced to this unique individual of Rav Aaron Cutler, who gains popularity and notoriety already in Europe, gets saved and brought over to America, has this vision for how to really save what he felt was save American Judaism. And what he felt at the time was the only way to save American Judaism was by creating an enclave that was separate and distinct, that shielded people from the disruptions of American culture. What started out as 14 students blossomed to this day, over 6,500 students, emerged into a philosophy of spreading the yeshiva and ultimately spun off to other movements like the religious Zionist movement, like the outreach movement, like YU, which now has community kolels. All of that is really an evolution of this philosophy that started in America in 1943. One thing is clear throughout the entire discussion, and we'll end with this. Torah has and always will transform our communities. That if we want American Judaism to survive, and if we want it to thrive and to persevere, it's always going to be on the backs of learning Torah, studying Torah, and teaching Torah. And so we should never take for granted the role that Torah plays in America, the role that Torah plays in our community, and we also shouldn't take for granted the explosion of Torah learning that exists in our day and age. If you were to tell people 50 years ago, 70 years ago, 100 years ago, that there would be more yeshivas in the world, that there would be 6,500 students learning in Lakewood, students learning in Baltimore, students learning in New York City, students learning around the world in various yeshivos at the numbers that they are now, no one would believe you. It really is one of the great miracles of our day and age, which is what we'll call colloquially the kolel movement. In other words, the movement for people to sit and to learn for many, many years. We should appreciate that, and we should feel very blessed to live in that generation. Everyone have a great night.